This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Oh my goodness, welcome to a beautiful, beautiful Sunday. Doesn't matter where you are today, inside, outside, Charlottesville, Albemarle, Harrisonburg, Lexington, Lynchburg, Richmond, or the latest edition, the Lovingston 94.7. This is truly a beautiful Sunday. And I think, aside from being beautiful, that you will find today's discussion to be educational and possibly exciting, because there's a lot of topic going on, a lot of discussion going on about the Middle East with one of my favorite guests. It's hard to, it's like children. You can't say truly that there's a favorite, but honestly, one of my favorite guests, Professor Emeritus from the University of Virginia, R.K. Ramazani. Professor, how are you today?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to come down here on a beautiful Sunday where you could have been, you know, swimming, jogging, playing with the pets, you know, racing around the county in your fancy car. But instead, you're here with me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we are going to talk today, Professor Ramazani, I guess your official title, Professor Emeritus of Government and Foreign Affairs. And I'll try and remember to say that throughout the hour. But we have you on to talk about the Middle East. Because that is your focus, correct? Iran, Iraq. You can talk a little bit about some of the other Middle Eastern countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, et cetera. And so we will be talking about that in a variety of ways, aside from what's going on there now, the change in the current administration's methodology of talking or not talking with these countries, depending on how we've handled it in the past, how the presidential election and the two major candidates are discussing their upcoming methods of dealing with any situations, good and bad, that there may be over there. So lots of interesting things upcoming in the hour with Professor Ramazani. Write down the number, stretch out those finger muscles, because you're going to want to be using them later on in the program. 979-0919, for those of you who are a little closer to WNRN. For those of you who are out and about, it is 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's right, that's the toll-free, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor, let's just jump into things right away. And this isn't necessarily your specialty, but in the last day or two, a current administration has removed North Korea from the bad guys list. And for whatever reason that they've done that, I'm curious as to how the other bad guys on the list, Iraq and Iran, what keeps them to be different than North Korea? Why are they still on the bad guys list?
Well, Iraq, of course, is not on the bad guys list because we are there in a war, and Iraq is a friend, the existing government. It's really Iran that is made one of the members of the Axis of Evil that President Bush branded Iran with North Korea and Iraq at that time. That was the time of Saddam Hussein, that Iraq was also a member of the Axis of Evil. Now, at the moment, Iran is still on the list of the Axis of Evil, and North Korea, given the way the conversations have been going on, there has been incentives provided for North Koreans to essentially ultimately abandon their nuclear weapon program. And this has had up and down because North Korea at times claims that U.S. has not been as forthcoming as should be in what we have promised to the North Koreans. And therefore, they have been foot-dragging at times, making us to be more forthcoming. And I think the present possible resumption of the six discussion is going to be useful and a right step in the right direction. I also think that we have to keep engaged with North Korea, and perhaps we will succeed by just keeping talking to them directly as well as indirectly. We haven't done that, any of that, with Iran. Iran has been blacklisted as really one of the worst of the axis of evil members. And there is a big discussion in this country as to whether or not we should talk to Iran. Now, one of the presidential candidates, as you know, Obama, has suggested from the beginning that we should talk to Iran without condition, precondition. The reason for precondition emphasis is that the present administration has insisted that we won't talk to Iran until and unless Iran stops enriching uranium. And we have gone to the United Nations Security Council for the same reason, to pressure Iran to stop enriching uranium. Now, Iranians argue that under the United Non-Proliferation Treaty, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they are entitled, Article 5 or 4, they are entitled to enriching uranium as long as it is for peaceful purposes. Therefore, they are not doing anything wrong and so on, and their program is not for bomb making. The issue of whether or not we should talk to Iran is very clear on the side of Obama, that we should talk, and we should talk without condition, so we can start talking. And that doesn't mean necessarily that Obama doesn't want to pressure Iran or sanction Iran further, but it is just that we should even talk to our enemies. We have talked to our enemies when the Soviets were our enemy and so on, and that's the best thing to do. You just don't talk about peace to your friends. You
know? But well, even, and as will happen dozens of times throughout the hour, as we talk with a university professor emeritus, R.K. Ramazani, about foreign policy in the Middle East, I'm sure that you will correct me throughout the hour because of my lack of expertise in this area. But your knowledge and your work in this area goes back decades. The President Bush administration is not the first administration to take this method of dealing with our enemies, to not chat with them at all. And yet he has changed at least a little bit in the way that he has chosen to do things now that he's near the end of his time. What makes the past 8 years with the Bush administration saying no and now a little bit, as opposed to the previous time that you have been studying and, sure, and working in this area with other people? Because the Bush administration has received an enormous amount of praise or anger,
yes,
at their choices. But how is that different from others?
You mean...
let's go back to Nixon or, yeah, to Nixon, Johnson, etc.
Nixon is a good example of how he opened talking and discussing and establishing relationship with China. And the so-called ping-pong approach to China. President Bush has been adamant on not talking to Iran until very recently, when there was a meeting of what is called six, that is five members of the Security Council and Germany, who, which is not a member of the Security Council.
So and who makes up the United States and Germany?
France,
Great Britain, Italy?
No, Italy is not involved. The permanent members, that is China, Russia, are involved. And then the last time that there was the discussion of the six with Iran, the president decided to send an envoy, a representative of the United States, which was quite a change. Some people, even Iranian Ahmadinejad, welcome that somehow U.S. has made a positive move toward Iran for the first time. Now, in terms of the axis of evil, Iraq really is different. We claimed, the Bush administration claimed, that they had weapons of mass destruction. And that was given as a rationale for invading Iraq. Well, everything has shown that to the contrary, there was no weapons of mass destruction, nor was there a relationship between any kind, operational relationship between the Al-Qaeda terrorists responsible for 9/11 attack and Saddam Hussein regime. Today, Iraq, of course, is in a war, and again, the candidates have different kind of a idea about the withdrawal of troops. When are we going to end this? And Obama has been on the record that in 16 months the troops would be withdrawn. And then there is a so-called tentative or draft agreement between the Bush administration and the Iraqi government. And that provides for a different kind. They don't call it timeline, they call it time goal. That the goal would be something by 2011, our withdrawal of forces start. And of course, McCain has gone on the basis of what is essentially a condition-based approach. That is, we don't set an artificial deadline, but we look at the situation on the ground. And if the situation is getting better, then we start talking about more seriously about troop withdrawal. But even in McCain's case, there is the notion of withdrawal really cutting across all these. The real problem with Iraq is the challenges of political processes. First of all, obviously, it's terribly important that Iraqi military will be in a position to take care of the situation security-wise after we have withdrawn. And that's not certain. But besides the military requirement, security requirement, there is the problem of politics. Iraq has yet to have a provincial election. Maybe by the end of January they will. And Iraq yet has to have a law, the implementation of a law that would be about who gets what from the oil income. And that is not really quite settled. Iraq is yet to, so to speak, bring back in to the service, government service, the former Ba'athist personnel. And problem, from my perspective, is not either absolutely military or political. From my perspective, from day one, we have not been able to read these countries' political culture. We have just assumed certain things, and we have been perfectly ignorant at times about the dynamics within these societies and cultures, whether or not democracy, for example, that we wanted to create in Iraq is going to work in a society that throughout centuries has known nothing.
Well, that's actually my next question on the list. Sure. Is there truly a need for democracy in the Middle East? It seems to be the gift that we would like to give to everyone. Everyone should love and have a democracy. It's like having, you know, everyone should experience a new car in their life so that they can have that new car smell. And if only everyone could taste democracy, it's all they would ever love to have again. Is it true that there's really a need for democracy there? And how difficult will it? We're learning how difficult it is to have one. How difficult will it be to have another? Assuming that that Iraq can have one, how difficult will it be to have a second at another country in the Middle East?
Well, we in Iraq, when we started after the invasion, the occupation, the idea was that we want to create not only a democratic, but a secular state. As of this moment, Iraq, by its constitution, is an Islamic republic. And also, in its constitution, the Islamic law, the Sharia, is a source of legislation. Both of these were not the desire we had, especially Paul Bremer, the American administrator at the time. So that question is also related to what right now we are expecting of these provincial elections, that the provincial election is an aspect of democracy, and provincial elections will make it possible to have a truly elected government, and that is a step in the democratic way, and so on. But again, my main concern is cultural and religious and sectarian and ethnic problems. Iraq is about 70%+ Arab. Then the second group is Kurds. And then the third group of any significance is Turkmens. And to try to bring these factions together, because through, let's say, provincial election, is quite a question, quite an important question, because there is a long-standing tradition in the Middle East, and I say across the board, that compromise is a bad thing. When you come to Iraq, therefore, to have a truly democratic Iraqi government, you would have to say the Shia majority that rules Iraq today would have to integrate the Sunnis into the process, the Turkmens into the process, representation for Christians in that process. And that, to me, is a very big idealistic way of looking at Iraq. And for that reason, I don't think Jefferson, you know, to go to the core fundamentals of our own society and politics, Jefferson was very interested in the spread of democracy. He called it liberty around the world. But before President Bush, no other American president ever made democracy spreading, promotion of democracy, the overriding goal of foreign policy in the United States. And Woodrow Wilson was interested in spreading democracy, Roosevelt was, but no one ever made that a central aspect of the American foreign policy. And therefore, we are going to be surprised that democracy, if it ever comes in these countries and cultures, would have to come from grassroots, would have to be from the inside. It cannot be imposed or exported from the outside.
Professor R.K. Ramazani here in the WNRN studio today as we talk about foreign policy in the Middle East. Professor Ramazani, UVA Professor Emeritus from Government at the University of Virginia. 11:20 on the wake-up call. We have a caller on the line. Caller, hang on just a second while I give everybody the weather today. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs in the mid-70s. Darn, isn't it nice out there. Clear tonight, lows 45 to 50. Then on Columbus Day, sunny tomorrow, highs 75 to 80. A few clouds across the listening area, 57 in the valley, 62 in Lynchburg, 59 in Richmond, and a beautiful 64 right now in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, let's thank 45fix.com for being with us today. If you have a home improvement project, there is another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate no-obligation estimates available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And WNRN wants to congratulate big winners, Stephen Robbins from Harrisonburg and Molly Hilton of Charlottesville, the most recent grand prize winners from the Fall 08 Fund Drive. Stephen won the complete desktop computer system from PC Pro Computer, and Molly will be enjoying the Virginia Film Festival the weekend of October 31st with a pair of producer's passes. Thank you to everyone who helped us reach nearly 82,000 in pledges. We're still accepting pledges over the phone or online at WNRN.org, and we still even have a few add-on premium items available. So dial us up. Speaking of dial us up, 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. If you'd like to make your comment or ask your question to Professor Ramazani, such as Gary. Gary, how are you?
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for hanging on. What you got?
Sure. I'd like to ask Dr. Ramazani a couple questions, and I'll just hang up and listen. First, I know his expertise in the Middle East, but I'd like him to tell us who he thinks are the most dangerous countries in the world right now. And secondly, a former candidate like Ron Paul really espouses isolationism, in my opinion. I'd like to have Dr. Ramazani talk about how isolated the United States could be by pulling back in some of our military from around the world and still be safe. So those two questions, I'll just hang up and listen.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it. Very important question. I am unable to say whom we really consider to be, in reality, in fact, the most dangerous. The propaganda machine says the most dangerous country, perhaps, is Iran. It's the threat to the world peace, etc. But your other part of the question is very important. We cannot be. Look at our economy right now. Look at what has been going on throughout this weekend. We are trying to get the countries of the world to go along with us because we are seeing so profoundly that our economy is interlinked with the economy of Europe, with the economy of Asia, and we cannot isolate ourselves economically from what is going on. That unilaterally we have decided $700 billion and all the rest in terms of efforts we are unilaterally making. But they're not bearing fruits. And now for the first time, a little too late, I think, there is so much talk about coordination with the Europeans, with Asians, with others. So globalization has negative and positive dimensions, but we can't escape it. Isolationism is impossible. There were the days that the two oceans on our sides made it possible for us to go it alone. But nowadays, no one, not just the United States, no country can ever go and do things by itself without the help of others, coordination, interaction with other countries and societies. That is my perspective.
All right. You can join in with Gary. Dial us up and ask your question or make your comment. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Excuse me. WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free line. And if you're afraid your voice is cracking like mine, then just give Deepak your question for the day, and I'll try and read it over the air. All right, Professor Emeritus R.K. Ramazani in the studio. We're talking about foreign policy in the Middle East. Professor, we obviously have the United States presidential elections upcoming, less than a month. You mentioned the elections in Iraq and an attempt to help there. I'm curious. Our election takes place in early November, but the new president doesn't move in until late January. What changes may other Middle Eastern countries make, or things that they may do once they know that there's a new United States president coming up, but he's not actually in place to make any decisions or reactions?
You mean in the transition?
Yes. Is there anything that we need to be concerned about or hope for? Either way, a good or a bad change during the presidential transition period from another Middle Eastern country. We always talk. We always talk about the Bush family being so close.
Yes.
To the Saudis.
Yes.
Is that going to be upsetting?
No.
To the Saudis, if
no.
McCain doesn't win, will some of the other countries that Bush has angered be more likely to make some changes on their own in a positive, at least towards the American manner, if Obama wins? Because they're happy to see the change from the Republican side of things?
Let me first say that there has been the world public opinion polls, and according to the public opinion polls worldwide, we have had the report to the effect about the unpopularity of the Bush administration and the hope, and this is not my saying, this is the poll result, that a great many people in the world are thinking that the American foreign policy, one, will change, and two, that there seems to be some preference in the Muslim world and beyond for Obama. Now, the transition period for us is a transition of great importance from one president to the other. The world knows about it. They are going to watch the transition. And they won't do anything because their policy, by and large, will be one of wait and see. That's the way they will calculate.
All right. Dial us up. Ask your questions. I still have a whole page full. We have the two different candidates. And let's go back to the discussions between the United States and the Middle Eastern countries. And you mentioned earlier the McCain policy, at least as he has come across, has been to be somewhat similar to the Bush administration of
situation on the ground.
Only preconditions. Sitting down, situation on the ground. Obama has said, let's talk. We don't need to have preconditions necessarily.
Oh, you mean on Iran?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I think his, unless I'm mistaken, Senator Obama has said that he will talk with, his administration will talk with almost anyone.
That's correct.
Without preconditions.
That's correct.
Let's try and be good neighbors.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you see that that either side is correct or incorrect, or is there a gray space in between where that may work for one country but not for another?
That's a very good question. I think my own perspective is, from looking at historical past, that it has never helped American national interests by not engaging. We have engaged our enemies in the past, and it has proven fruitful. Again, I go back to the Soviet Union. Mortal enemy, we considered during the Cold War. But we never had a letdown in our diplomatic relations ever since the 30s when it was established. So, talking to enemies again in regard to peace, I believe, is important. Now, in regard to the candidates, Obama certainly has clearly said no, we should talk, and no conditions. Five former Secretary of States have recently stated clearly that we should talk to Iran. Now, if that is not good enough, I don't know what is.
Let me ask you, because this comes up in almost all of the news bits that we see, the debates about Henry Kissinger, who you have worked with, correct?
Not really, not Henry Kissinger. I work with Brzezinski.
Henry Kissinger has, depending on who you talk to, either did or did not say that we should speak with these countries with preconditions. The Republicans say, of course, he would never say that. No, 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 we must have preconditions. And the Democratic Party has said, no, he said that we should sit down with him as well.
Kissinger has also joined the crowd saying that we should talk to Iran. What has been disputed is what levels. You see, in the debate, it came out on the Republican side that you mean you sit down with Ahmadinejad.
Right, the president flies over and sits down.
Yeah. In other words, the level of discussion. And when the debate went on, and after the debate, Kissinger somehow tried to say that I haven't said at the level of the president. But that didn't mean that Kissinger doesn't endorse talking to Iran. And as I said, five former Secretary of State have gone for the talking with Iran. The other thing that Rick, you mentioned, if I may go back to this matter of core really problems, challenges to us, is Afghanistan. Again, the question, after the defeat of Taliban, with Iran's help, by the way, we thought, again, we are going to produce a democratic, secular government. And Afghanistan now is called the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. And they also use Islamic law as a source of legislation. Now, the difference between the two candidates on Afghanistan question is quite interesting. Obama insists that the center of terrorism is in Afghanistan and has always been, and we should not have been distracted by going to Iraq and gotten the situation so grim in Afghanistan. Now, given that, Senator McCain says that the center of terrorism is in Iraq, continues to be in Iraq. That's a big difference between the two. Nevertheless, both candidates have acknowledged that there is a need for increase of troops in Afghanistan in order to bring security about. Now, the commander, U.S. commander in Afghanistan, has called urgently for addition troops. What he has interestingly said is that we cannot have the Iraq-style surge in Afghanistan, because the surge, apart from increasing of the number of troops in Iraq, has involved more or less co-opting tribal leaders. They are on our way, pay, so to speak. And therefore, this reduction of violence is attributed also, or maybe significantly, to the fact that we have been able to get the Sunni tribes on our side. Now, the commander in Afghanistan, U.S. commander, doesn't think that that kind of a thing we can do in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, you know, Rick, is extremely complicated country. From the time of the Medians and the Persians and the Mongols, and so on, all the invasions, and the latest, of course, the Soviet invasion and our invasion, and now NATO involved in the Afghan situation, I consider to be much more serious for the future than it is so much in Iraq. You have a majority of the Pashtuns, then you have the Uzbeks, then you have the Hazaris who are Shias. So you have such a multitude of tribes and tribal lords that it is very difficult to have even a cohesive state, let alone a democratic state, in Afghanistan. So I consider the Afghan situation much more serious. And yet I don't believe the situation can be helped by increase of troops alone. I think what is desperately needed in Afghanistan is to do something about this heroin trade, which is 50% of Afghanistan's economy, and where the revenues go to the support of the terrorists who launch attacks constantly into Afghan territory, in fact have seized Afghan territory in certain areas by using the haven in Pakistan and raiding into Afghanistan. I think that is probably the greatest danger, challenge. It's not of a country, but it is this particular situation which I consider to be the greatest challenge to future President of the United States.
So it sounds to me as though you are, and I'm not saying that you would vote for this individual, but it sounds to me as that you are more in agreement with Senator Obama, sure, in bringing a greater focus to Afghanistan and Pakistan, rather than put them well below. Yeah. It seems like Senator McCain has them third and fourth on his list, with a large gap between Iran and Iraq and what needs to happen there. And Senator Obama is at least making Afghan and Pakistan on an equal level of importance, if not slightly higher.
I don't want to talk publicly about my own preference.
Well, let's focus on what the two of them are saying, and that it seems that you would be in agreement with with Senator Obama in the need to bring these other two countries and the focus diplomatically and financially on doing something about what is going on there that is harming the United States.
Yeah, extremely. I again, you know, Eric, I am not registered Democrat or Republican. I'm a student of world affairs, and after 56 years of teaching and writing and talking, when I come to a conclusion, it's not because of following Obama or McCain. It's because of my own reading and understanding of the situation. And in that respect, yes, you're correct. I believe that the center of terrorism is not in Iraq. In fact, Al-Qaeda has been quite controlled, contained in Iraq. It is Afghanistan that is the major problem.
All right, 11:40 here in the wake-up call with University of Virginia Professor Emeritus R.K. Ramazani. That's R-A-M-A-Z-A-N-I, because I believe that my personal public opinion is that you should go online and pull up some of his many articles that have been written on this. If you aren't sure who to wake up and vote for on election day, just the fact that you would like to be more or better informed about the topic in general, even if you have already made your decision. That's University of Virginia Professor R.K. Ramazani. 11:40 here on the wake-up call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
In 1958, Virginia Governor Lindsey Almond's decision to close schools in Charlottesville, Norfolk, and Warren County stunned the nation, making the 2008 presidential race seem all the more incredible when only 50 years ago, children of different races couldn't even attend school together. The Hook looks at history. Plus, news about area restaurants, art, and music make The Hook always deserving of your vote. Let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for helping us be on the air today. Blue Ridge has gear for the coming season, including fleece and rain shells for men, women, and kids. You'll also find shoes for city, school, or mountain trails. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Berwick Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville. They're at Wintergreen and in the Chesterfield Town Center at Richmond, plus BRMS.com. We also want to let you know about the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice, presenting author Vincent Bugliosi on Thursday, October 16th at 7 p.m. in the Albemarle County Office Building. Vincent Bugliosi, prosecutor of Charles Manson and author of Helter Skelter, will talk about his newest book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. For more information, charlottesvillepeace.org. And we got about 20 minutes left. Don't go anywhere. Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue. If French isn't your thing, in NRN speak, that's The Times Gone By. That's 80s and 90s alternative music. Tune in for it next. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. All right, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. You can also send us the instant message, WNRN Studio. And, Professor, this next question comes that way. It's a two-part question. Israel's role, how immediate is there danger from other countries? I'll let you answer that, and then I'll ask part B.
Propaganda machine says that Iran is going to use weapons, missiles, and hit Israel because President Ahmadinejad at one time talked about what is well known, wiping Israel off the map and stinking corpse. And so the verbal situation has been extremely hostile both on both sides. Israel considers Iran as what they call, quote-unquote, existential threat to Israel. That is the way Israelis perceive it, and many in the United States perceive that is the case. But I talk as a scholar of a student area, and especially Iran. Iran considers the United States as the number one enemy, not Israel. The remarks of Ahmadinejad, I am on record, I consider them to have been imprudent. It is in print and inappropriate. and hurt Iran's international image, and rightly so. So, but if we are getting away from what the headline says and what one side said or the other, I think the situation is far more complicated. At the moment, the Iranian notion of threat is because we have thousands of troops on both sides of the country. We have thousands of troops in Iraq. We have thousands of troops in Afghanistan, and Iran is sitting right in the middle. And we, of course, criticize Iran for being meddling, so to speak, meddling in Iraq. But Iranians say, you are the meddlers coming thousands of miles away and sitting in our backyard, occupying it. So that is really Iran's concern. And that is Israel's absolutely everyone that I know of any kind of a ranking in Israel considers Iran as the existential threat.
I have a caller on the line. Caller, hang out 1 second. And I'm going to get to part B of that question in a minute. So whoever sent that instant message, hang on for a second too. But my own follow-up to that is that quote did not come from a theocratic leader in Iran.
No.
Does that make it less important?
It doesn't make it less important. I believe rhetoric in world affairs, just as in our own societies, is as important at times as action. So that is the point. The real thing is that Ahmadinejad is not Iranian regime. Within the Iranian constitutional structure, president does not have the ultimate power and does not have the ultimate say. Nevertheless, understandably, the outside world look at Iranian president and tend to think, this is what every Iranian believes, which is far from it. This is what every Iranian leader believes, which is not the case. So, again, in regard to the issue, the rhetoric counts, but I don't think the rhetoric, on the one hand, the rhetoric is important, but on the other hand, if it is coming from an Iranian president, whether Ahmadinejad or any other, we have to understand it, that they don't have the ultimate say.
All right, I'll get back to part B of that Israeli question in a moment. Let's take the call on the phone line. We got Tom. Hey, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for dialing in. Your question, your comment?
I'd like to ask the professor, with respect to the notion of the difficulty or even impossibility of exporting democracy, what would his response be to those who might point to post-World War II Japan, which seems, I think, could be used as an example of the United States having successfully done that? In other words, what's different about Japanese society and culture that made democracy or the exportation of democracy a success there?
Tom, can you listen to the answer on the radio?
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
All right, man. Thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you.
From your question, I surmise that you know a lot because you talk about societies and culture. Let me be very clear. That is a false analogy. I don't mean you making it, but many have made it. Why is it false? For two fundamental reasons. Iraq, Afghanistan, these are essentially tribal societies. Japan and Germany were modern, industrialized, advanced societies. We are talking about two very different situation, very different cultures and society. Secondly, and no, in my view, no less important, Germany threatened the world peace, as did Japan. But we are the ones who invaded Iraq. Who would doubt that? So when you invade and then you preach democracy, then it is obvious that people infer that you can also not just export by peaceful means, which I am for it, but by even coercion. Jefferson would turn over in his grave if anyone talked about combining pressure, coercion, with the spreading, promoting democracy. You know what Jefferson really thought? He thought the best way to spread liberty is by our example. That's what Jefferson said. I have quotations. I also have just published an article in the journal called Critique, and the title of which is President Bush Deviates from Core American Principles in Middle East Policies. This is Critique, a journal on the Middle East, and published in September. So the analogy is not warranted, if I may say so.
This is Professor R.K. Ramazani. That's R-A-M-A-Z-A-N-I. Go online. Pull up some of these articles. Make your own decisions. 11:51 here on the Wake Up Call with a professor here in the studio today. 979-0919-1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. 11:52, time for another phone call or two, if you'd like. Professor, let me get back to the Israeli question. We were talking about their role and how immediate their danger from other countries is. The part B of that is, do they sometimes exacerbate their own problem, knowing that we will always come to their aid?
I didn't quite get the question.
Does Israel sometimes exacerbate their own problems, knowing that we will come to their aid?
That's a very good question. I think I understand when the Israeli Prime Minister, who is going out, Olmert, when he was in Washington, this was reported, one-to-one discussion with President Bush. Apparently, reportedly, he was seeking some kind of a green light for striking Iran's nuclear facilities. And I understand that it was not given to the Israeli Prime Minister. Now, the threats Israel made in terms of Iran, there is a record that Israel at times has taken unilateral action, such as the one in Osirak in Iraq in 1981, when the Israelis simply went after the nuclear facilities of Iraq and demolished. In regard to Syria, more recently suspected nuclear facilities, they went in on their own, we thought, but apparently there was some kind of an intelligence exchange between us and the Israelis on that issue. So, I don't believe that Israel really would, on its own, in disregard of the American policy, will go to bomb or whatever to strike Iran's nuclear facilities.
All right, this is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Let me take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be on the air today. You can find Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, serving us with custom t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, Professor, only a few minutes left in today's program. I'm curious, does age play a role in foreign policy now, with especially when we're talking to countries like Iran, that where the younger citizens have taken on such a greater acceptance of Western culture, even though the true leaders, the regime, I believe you used earlier, still does not. Is there a way for American policy to somehow, you know, embed themselves from the bottom up?
This is very important question, because this is one of the most misunderstood thing about that country. I would like to be on the record that within the Middle East, except for Israel, and to an extent Turkey, Iran happens to have, in 70-plus million people, happen to have the most pro-American, this was revealed by public opinion poll, the most pro-American in the sense of wanting to establish, resume diplomatic relations with America. And also, if you realize that Iran has had from 1906, when it first established through a revolution called Constitutional Revolution, established a quote-unquote democratic government, a parliament, adopted the Constitution. And therefore, over 100 years, there has been quest for democracy in that country. These are not known. I believe, if I may say so, Rick, you were kind enough to say that I'm your favorite guest or one of many. I can't tell you about why I think this station is my favorite. Because it is, in my sense, its mission is education. And Jefferson, if I may say so again, believed that the best way to spread democracy or liberty is to educate the public. In his words, only well-informed people can be entrusted with their government. A lot of problems we have in America today is because of lack of information, misinformation, disinformation. And therefore, I think this is the way my thinking is all along, that we cannot live in a society claiming democracy when 80% of our college students cannot find Afghanistan or Iraq on the map. That is where our main problem is. That is why we go by emotion rather than reflection.
Well, I appreciate the kind words about the station, Professor. And I hope that as we are at the last minute of my hour, I hope that once we have our election, and please, it's too late to register, but if you are registered, it would be so wonderful to actually see anywhere close to 100% of the registration show up, rather than much of the 20 or 30% we've seen in previous years. And I hope that once our decision is made, that you will come back and join me again sometime in the spring or so to discuss what our new administration has set forth as their plans. Professor R.K. Ramazani joining us today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And next week, it is set on the schedule, although the names are not set. We will have a political surrogate from the Senator Obama campaign and another from Senator McCain's campaign to discuss what each of those candidates will do, sort of our own mini debate where maybe I can actually get these folks to answer the questions for us. Drew Thompson up next, Les Timms Perdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.